Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, the latest geek culture news, and whatever movies, TV, and other pop culture is on our radar for the week. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now, on with the show. We are back, and first of all, start off with Game with Rogues, Boss Monster, Saturday, January 21st. Come out for it. It'll be fun.
Yes.
Also, we are heading into February very soon. Doesn't seem like soon now, but it will be in, like, it'll rush past us like every other month does.
Yeah. Well, what are we like? We're a third of the way.
We're a little way through.
Yeah.
And in February, we have our yearly clearance sale, which we do. We clear out some stuff that hasn't sold for a little while. There's always some heartbreaker graphic novels and games on there. They're like, oh, these are great. Why didn't people buy them?
Yep.
But the upside is you get to buy them for like 50% off or more.
Yep. And you get to roll the bones.
Yes.
Which is to say you roll, 2 6-siders?
Yep.
At the counter, and you add the 2 to 12 extra percentage points you'll roll onto whatever you get for bonus damage.
Yep. Bonus discount. And if you have a rogue card, you just present that, and then you don't have to roll. You get a critical hit. You get max damage.
Yes.
So that's pretty cool. And we'll have the whole list of that stuff up. It'll be up on tables on February 1st, basically. All right, let's get into the news.
Yeah. Do we need to mention the magic thing?
Oh, yeah, there's a magic pre-release.
Magic pre-release this coming Sunday?
On Sunday.
Yep.
Yep.
There, we did it. there's one from noon to 4, and then there's a 4 to 7-ish session. And what's the new one called?
Aether Revolt. You ask me this every couple of days.
Yeah. I'm not going to get it until I actually see the product.
But I keep forgetting, and now
I was asking for the viewers this time, ready, right. Or the listeners.
Yep.
I don't give a shit.
I'm just saying, every time you ask, I have to think because I don't remember either. Anyway, that's what Google is for, Dave.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But I couldn't Google it right in the middle of the podcast.
That's true.
That you might know.
You could. You have a phone.
Since you're like Odin lore master.
Yeah, that's me.
You gave up your eye for knowledge.
Yeah, I did. Actually, it was for a sweet ride, which I then crashed.
Odin's low rider.
Odin's low rider. And so let's go with the first bit of news we got, which is, Jesus, that ugly costume for Scarlet Spider.
Oh, this is weird. We're starting out with negative news.
It's an unfortunate thing because I think everybody's kind of excited to see Ben Reilly back as Scarlet Spider.
First of all, I forgot that this comic was coming out, though. It is Ben Reilly.
It's Ben Reilly. He's in the Clone Saga. I don't want to give away what's going on, but it was a pretty big reveal in Clone Conspiracy number 3.
Is he going to be doing hero-y type things?
We don't know, but I suspect he's a hero-y, hero-y type thing.
But it's written by Peter David.
It's Peter David. Mark Bagley's on art.
Yeah.
And it has...
You normally think this is going to be a fun book.
Yeah, I mean, I think it will be a fun book, but to put it a cover... And one of the things I think, and I'm not sure because I'm not a Ben Reilly guy, but one of the things I think people really liked about Ben Reilly is they like the costume. His, like... half, you know,
his hoodie thing,
his hoodie sweater vest thing that he's got. It's goofy
wasn't
looking,
it
but
like kind of like didn't it like have like torn sleeve? I mean, it was sleeveless, but he had like the torn sort of vest thing.
It was like a hoodie vest.
Yeah.
Now
it's fair. It's a little '90s, but
I
it's
think
a good
everybody
costume.
Knows who Ben 90s? Reilly is like a clone of Spider-Man from this big, you know, convoluted clone saga in the '90s.
If they don't know, none of this is all gibberish to them.
Then it's all gibberish. But he was like, he's always been like the edgy Spider-Man. That's the main thing to do.
No,
he was like was the quintessential like Peter Parker kind of guy.
Yeah, you're thinking of Kane.
You're thinking of Kane. Kane's the edgy one.
Yeah, Ben
I
Reilly.
Ben Reilly was edgy and like an angsty and stuff.
No, oh. Ben Reilly was Peter Parker. There was the whole thing that they thought he might be Peter Parker.
Yeah, that was.
Well,
the whole...
what did he do?
He came in and took over, and Peter Parker retired.
I thought the one or two issues I had of it that John Romita drew at the time showed him all wandering, like no mask and doing good deeds, but kind of being grim and lonely.
Well, that's how they introduced him, and then he got.
All right, so he was once
was
upon a time.
For the
yeah,
series.
That's all I ask.
Yeah, he's just like you always think of Steve Rogers, like oh, that guy's an agent of Hydra.
That is not to read crappy comics in the 90s is what I knew.
And see where it gets you? You do not have the knowledge of Odin Low Rent Loremeister. which I also have not read a ton of Ben Reilly. But my larger point is 90s costume, but it was a good costume.
It was.
And the new one is really bad.
Yeah, there were a few good costumes in the 90s. I'm going to say Superboy. The new Superboy
Was
a good one. That was very 90s, but looked good.
Yep.
All the X-Men had pretty decent costumes.
Ben Reilly had a good one. Yeah, Jim Lee did some good X-Men versions that were just like kind of took what had been going around before and spruced them up Jim Lee style.
Yeah, you know, those 90s Jim Lee costumes, I mean, Rogue, Cyclops, none of them are my favorites, but they're solid costumes.
Yep.
But, yeah, this one's, it's a weird, this is Mark Bagley. He's generally decent at costume design. It's just, it doesn't really work.
He's shown to be with his work on the original Thunderbolts.
New Warriors. Yeah, it's
now,
a little
New
weird.
Warriors, weren't those like just made up though of people like Nova and stuff like that who were already around?
He probably designed Night Thrasher.
Yeah, he designed Night Thrasher, which is a good costume.
Are we going with that?
Yes.
Okay.
He tweaked both Nova and Marvel Boy and did good tweaks on both of those. And I guess that's it.
Speedball?
Okay. Speedball was Ditko design.
Oh, that was Ditko.
Yeah. At any rate, his Thunderbolt designs were all good. And it's just, it's kind of weird to see, and I think this has been pilloried online. I think it just like, feel like, oh, what is that?
Could this have been a fake out? Do you think he just did a quick cover and then it was like,
if he was here right now, tears would be running down his eyes. Nope. And you're like, did you make it so bad as a joke?
No, but that's what they should say the story is and go back to the original costume and then say the fans demanded it. That's what they should do.
Are we going to link to this costume so people can see this eyesore?
I will try to remember to link
to this
costume.
He's got like a hood.
Yep.
And like, you know, it's got the blue and red Spider-Man colors you expect, but it is just a messy combination.
It looks like a weird combination of Kane's outfit, but with a hood.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's
Kane
really
the angsty
weird.
Spider-Man.
Kane the angsty Spider-Man.
Not at
angsty.
All like Ben Reilly, the lovable, practically Peter Parker
Kane's
Spider-Man.
Like a murderous
I thought Peter Parker was the Peter Parker Spider-Man, but I guess Ben Reilly is the Peter Parker Spider-Man.
Ooh, totally is.
You know, there was a whole period where that was true.
Yeah.
And Kane is like the murderous one.
Yeah,
he will actually kill.
Yeah, no, I thought that Ben Reilly just landed somewhere in between. I just thought he was like a kind of edgier one.
No, Ben Reilly is basically Peter Parker for people who didn't like Peter Parker.
Hmm.
Peter Parker was all married and stuff, and they're like, "Oh, we want young and swinging Spider-Man," and that's what they
got. Why didn't Quesada just make him Ben Reilly as Spider-Man?
Because it's easier to have the devil divorce them.
I guess
it's a lesson for all the kids out there. If you need a divorce, go to Mephisto.
He's got a pretty long line, though.
Yeah, so. That's true. I think that probably they were trying to do a Spider-Gwen thing with the hood.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a
also,
weirdly...
Also, I suspect that Bagley is not actually a great costume designer. That he had a couple decent ones in the 90s where he kind of plugged into a 90s visual style. Yep. Or maybe a little just more of a timeless visual style that worked well. But I think he's a little bit maybe like John Romita, consummate storyteller. That'd say John Romita Jr., consummate storyteller, not a super inspired designer of looks.
That's a reasonable point.
Not a fashionista.
So you're saying Mark Bagley is going to come in here and cry because you're just going to bash him.
To give this costume a little bit of benefit of the doubt, perhaps that sort of just like when we see the first shots of movie costumes and we're like, oh, that looks El Crapo for like a superhero costume.
Uh-huh.
And then in motion, it looks cool. Maybe with his storytelling, he is a very expert storyteller. Maybe it'll look passable.
I will say, possible. I'm not super thrilled with Hydra Cap and I've gotten used to it.
I still don't like that costume.
So...
But that is a good comparison. It's not like an outrage.
No.
Does Cap have a different costume right now?
Yeah, and he's got that weird kind of shield that can separate and have, like, energy edges.
Right. Yeah. That's, the more triangular, traditional one.
Yeah.
But I guess I thought he was still rolling with the regular costume. I haven't been reading Steve Rogers' Cap for a
bit. That's different.
And I think it was Pacheco that designed it.
It was Carlos Pacheco.
But it's just not great. Maybe really, really great artists aren't always the best designers.
It's possible.
I don't know. Speaking of, now, Scarlet Spider, I think it's probably a fun return to the 90s. Something not fun from the 90s is returning, though, possibly to your theater near you, and that is the Extreme Shared Universe.
Right. This is Rob Liefeld's...
Rob Liefeld, creator of Youngblood and...
Brigade.
Chances are, if you lived in the 90s, you have some of his books, and you either still have a shameful love of it...
Yep.
Or you should be shameful.
Yep.
Or... You purged your library of it, and you tell people you didn't have it, but you did.
Well, he is teaming up with Hollywood superstar screenwriter, writer of such great gems as Batman and Robin.
Right.
And Lost in Space.
Yep.
Akiva Goldsman, to create a shared universe based on Youngblood and Brigade and Bloodstrike. So
did he have Supreme to his name?
Supreme is part of it, yeah.
Which did, you know, like get Alan Moore writing it at some point. So here's the thing that I wondered about, because it sounds, of course, like a mess.
Terrible.
In the process of becoming a movie, is it possible that it'll go through one of those sort of Mark Miller-ish transformations into a film that sort of sometimes his stuff bears resemblance to his comics, sometimes it pretty much becomes its own thing. Like, you know, Wanted or sure. whatever, or even, like, Kingsman was pretty different, wasn't it?
Yes, the Kingsman, yeah.
yeah.
Here's the thing. I think that's very possible, but when you throw in Akiva Goldsman as the guy behind the writer's room, you're basically, that's not a good start.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out if, you know, if it could end up looking like, you know, will they cover some territory, like, that hasn't been covered yet, and end up with, like, a surprise hit movie or something?
Here's what I think is most likely. I believe we'll see a lot of the extras.
Be more like a high-budget Mantis.
I think we'll see a lot of extras, the development artwork and that kind of thing from this, on the DVD of The Mark, the movie that Liefeld has starring Will Smith, which is a movie that never came out either.
Did it actually...
No, they never made it.
Never made it.
And that's what... Liefeld is like a low-rent Mark Miller. He announces all these projects, and they never get made.
Right.
So I believe this is another one of those, this isn't going to happen.
See, this podcast off to a depressing start. Bad costumes, bad movie crossovers. It's sad.
Yeah, so let's just pile on through to the next one, which is The Powerless is coming out. This is the NBC sitcom starring Danny Pudi from Community, Alan Tudyk from Rogue One and Firefly, yeah. Vanessa Hudgens, who I don't know where she's from.
She's like one of those Disney girls.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is their... It was supposed to originally be like an insurance agency in the DC Universe. Well, they released their first trailer.
What's it called again?
Powerless.
Powerless, right.
They released their first trailer and is not good.
Yeah. It's kind of hokey. I mean, it's what we knew it was like conceptually. Workplace comedy in the DC Universe. I guess specifically in... Is it in Gotham now? Or they mentioned like Wayne Industries or something.
Yeah, they
like
did.
That.
The weird thing is like... we've seen various versions of this be funny, like Better Off Ted, The Office. We've seen funny office comedies, and we've seen Damage Control of the Marvel Universe be a funny thing about sort of the guys who clean up the superheroes. Like, there's plenty of room to play here, and they've got Danny Pudi, they've got Alan Tudyk, and it just does not look like it came together. Now, maybe it's a bad trailer, but usually the trailer is like the best stuff they have, and this is the best stuff they've got. We're in trouble.
Yeah, that's very true.
It's a rough trailer.
Yeah, it's funny. This is an intentional comedy.
Yeah.
Like, Flash and like, Supergirl are shows that have little comedic elements, and they're otherwise being a, you know, sort of an adventure drama. But their, like, comedy is, like, laugh out loud when they do it. Like, it's, like, well done, you know, pretty witty timing.
Yeah.
This one felt, like, off time.
This was
And it was, like, a teaser trailer, too. It was, like, maybe, like, 30 seconds long.
Yep.
And if, like you said, if this is the best they have,
I'm holding.
I'm just not sure who the audience is. Even if it's better than it looks, I still don't know that it could find an audience.
It can work. I mean, a DC sort of office comedy about, you know, surviving in a world with superheroes has some legs.
What was it they have, like, you know, there's insurance against superhero jokes.
And then, of course...
What was that? They were, like, protective, some sort of, like...
They deal with, like, you know, gadgets and stuff that will actually...
To protect you in case you're, like, it randomly out there and the superhero fight happens.
Yeah.
You know what it looked like? It looked like an ad for an actual insurance company. Like, J.K. Simmons could be starring in it, and it'd be like, this is the State Farm goofy ad about what it'd be like if there were superheroes in our world and we had insurance. Like, 30-second bits, but they'd be better.
But, Randy, those J.K. Simmons insurance commercials are way better.
Those are glorious, and I'm saying that is the level they couldn't even quite rise to, but that's about where it looks like they're aiming.
Mm.
Yeah, so, well...
I'm going to watch the pilot.
Oh, me too. Absolutely. But I'm not excited about it.
Y'all tell me how that one comes out.
I can tell you now.
We're gluttons for punishment when it comes to television.
All right, so I'm going to roll the bad news on. We got a couple good news to brighten you guys up at the end. We've got some really good cartoons for you kids. Just stick around. The show we mentioned last week that they're developing is Black Lightning is being developed for Fox.
Yes.
However, Greg Berlanti has said that if it goes to Fox, it will not cross over with the other DC superhero shows.
Right, he's just decided that it functions better, like, as a solo series?
And that...
Is that right?
Yeah, I get the point. I mean, like, Gotham shouldn't be in the DC shared universe either, but I feel like that's a mistake. Like, a Black Lightning show that ties into the DC...
Honestly, at this point, just throw Gotham into the DC shared universe.
No.
That's a little too weird and murdery.
Yeah, that'd be like revealing that Batman and Robin is in continuity with Man of Steel.
What was the thing that was going to be like a feature film that was going to be separate from
I don't remember.
There was something that we talked about like a few months ago.
Talk about Booster Gold?
Yeah, Booster Gold. And I'm just like, Booster Gold is like a particularly a character that I would say fits a broad DC universe, because he can time travel and he can go back and meet Enemy Ace and he can go back and meet Anthro and all that other stuff in the DC universe. And yes, it could function on its own, but it's funnest, but I think, why? DC property. Black Lightning is a character who, frankly, as a character, he's always been a little bit boring to me.
Yeah.
But I've seen him in some pretty decent stories. But I would say he's going to, like the Flash, he's probably going to need some people to play off of. And, you know, you can give him a good supporting cast. But I think he'd be funnest in a shared universe.
I agree. I think there's two silver linings here.
Yeah.
One is that I suspect we could get a pretty good Black Lightning standalone show. Like a story about Black Lightning where he's either a school teacher or a, you know, somewhere, someone who's like a social worker or whatever, whatever you put him on. You could do a really good cast around that and then have him be fighting sort of street crime and that kind of thing.
I think they were going to go the older route where he had a daughter and everything. That's what I heard.
Are they? Because that's, I mean, that's new. The notion of him having a daughter is brand new.
I mean, he's had it.
But that was invented by Jubb Winnick.
Yeah, that's true.
So if they
I
do that,
think
that's...
that would be okay if they did that. You know, a dad passing on his lineage to his daughter would be kind of an interesting dynamic.
And it was kind of fun because if they go the way the comic did, she didn't want to be a superhero to start with.
No, she wanted to be a superhero. He didn't want her to be.
Oh, is that the
deal? Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But at any rate, there's any number of good takes on Black Lightning. It don't require him to be the DC Universe that I think could be really interesting. But the other silver lining is, this is almost exactly what they said about Supergirl.
Yeah.
When it was on CBS, they said, yeah, it's probably going to be off on its own. And while, yeah, it is kind of a pain that Supergirl has to cross worlds to be on Flash and stuff, she definitely feels part of the universe now that the CW did the crossover.
Right.
So if it's successful...
They do all these promo videos and stuff like that with her hanging out with them and everything.
Yeah. If it's successful, I would imagine we'll see Black Lightning crossing over. It's a little weird to be on another Earth.
Yeah.
But I can see where they want to give each showrunner their own individual...
Earth Berenstein.
Control Earth Berenstein. Berenstein Lightning.
Now, here's my question. Are they in fact going to call him Black Lightning?
I imagine.
Kind of a throwback name
to
the weird naming phenomena of the racist 60s and 70s?
No, they're just going to call him Lightning.
I mean, they could.
Lightning's a weird name. Black Lightning's a good name.
I like it, and it sounds cool. but it's Green Arrow does not refer to his race, and Black Lightning does, and that's what's one of those kind of weird old blaxploitation traditions.
I guess. I don't know. I feel like that's a name that sort of... I'm like,
Black well, I like it, but he does not shoot out lightning bolts that are black in nature.
He's a black costume, though.
I thought it was blue.
Blue lightning's weird.
You know, sometimes blue is supposed to be red as black in the comics. Yeah. I don't know if it's supposed to be black or not.
I don't know. All I know is that, like,
that's true.
Black Goliath is not a good name.
Right.
Black Panther works,
right?
But it's a black costume,
right?
Black Lightning, for whatever reason, is never one of those. I'm like, oh, this is dated and they should change it. I like Black Lightning. It's
I know.
It sounds
surprised
cool
that they didn't. It seems like the kind of thing that they would.
Black Racer works.
Black Racer, yes, he has a black costume. Also, he represents death. Yes. Okay. The good news.
Yep.
Constantine is coming back to the CW.
Yay.
Except it's the CW Seed, so it's their online, and it's animated.
Right. It's going to be cartoon.
That is
but
weird.
It's Matt Ryan.
But
right?
It's Matt Ryan doing the. I don't know why they don't just pull the trigger. Maybe they're afraid to do something that NBC didn't fail, but if they just put a Constantine show on or just put it back on, just like they did with Supergirl, rescue it, it'd do well for them and they could bring in the DC Universe.
But they already have Supernatural still going.
They do, and maybe that's why.
I mean, it feels like it's in that ballpark.
Yeah.
If that was going off the air, I wonder if they're like, well, we know this is going to end sometime in the next few years. Let's keep Constantine in their people's imagination with the animation and stuff like this, so that when Supernatural goes off, Constantine can come on.
I think you just go crazy. You bring Supernatural into the DC Universe, and you have them meet Constantine.
You know what? I think you guys are underestimating Supernatural. That show is now on its, like, 13th season. It's never going off the air. It's going to be like The Simpsons.
Yeah.
Season 30 will feature Sam and Dean hunting monsters with their grandkids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's accurate.
So, but I do think that, Dave, you're probably right. I think that's probably why they didn't put Constantine on. Like, well, we've already got a show where it's a guy dealing with the supernatural.
Yeah.
So, you may be right. But anyway, this is cool for those who really like the Constantine show, which I know, Nick, you're among those people.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
And I like the Vixen Seed thing they did. I'm cool with it. And if they do it with Vixen, they'll probably wind up bringing him back into live action.
He also stands to be more high profile after that Justice League Dark movie coming up.
Which I'm sure is part of why we're getting it.
Yeah.
I think, honestly, I would rather they just bring him live action into Legends of Tomorrow. Just add him as a cast member. But whatever, maybe they will. Finally, actual good news for those who like video games. We have release dates for Injustice 2 and Mass Effect Andromeda.
Yay. Uh-huh.
So Injustice 2 is coming up on May 16th. And
I was going to say, of Injustice 2, I'm a little worried about it. Not in like a major way, but in like it had, I think, a pretty good story to it. And, you know, I liked what they did. I'm worried that they won't be able to follow through.
There was something, I can't remember what it was, but there was something, I always had the same worry, and there was something where they told what the story was going to be, and I was like, oh, that's a good twist.
Okay.
I don't remember what it was.
I played it like on easy level just so I could see all the story events, and I like the gameplay was fun enough, but I'm actually more there for the story, honestly.
But Tom Taylor's going to write the comic.
Nice.
So, you know, you get that.
He should. That should be his thing.
Yeah. Well, it is Tom Taylor Tuesday.
Yeah. For those who don't know, Tom Taylor, who writes the Injustice comic and has done such a good job on it, writes all new Wolverine and other stuff. Wrote like three books that came out today, and thus making it
Tom Taylor Tuesday.
Tom Taylor Tuesday.
And Mass Effect Andromeda is coming even sooner. That is March 21st.
That's really soon.
I'm excited for Mass Effect Andromeda. I'm looking forward to playing it.
So that one is set in stone, huh?
Yeah.
Why do you think they waited to so close to finalize it?
I don't know. I assume
they're hedging their bets a little bit. They were like, we might make this deadline, but we don't want to.
I think they were probably trying to throw the Reapers off the game. They want to make sure the Reapers didn't attack.
This will have no Reapers.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, the Andromedans.
That's because they threw them off their game.
Yes, exactly.
if you played Mass Effect 3, you would know what happened to the Reapers.
I like still have to finish it.
All right, that's it. We'll be back in just a second with more comics news. We're talking comics for the week of Wednesday, January 11th, and as previously announced, it's Tom Taylor Tuesday.
Tom Taylor Tuesday.
Although for those of you buying the books, it's Tom Taylor Wednesday. But that is not alliterative and therefore terrible.
It doesn't have the same ring to it.
So let's start off, Nick, with the Tom Taylor book that makes it Tom Taylor Tuesday.
Sure. And I posted about this on Facebook before because I was super excited about it because of Tom Taylor. And that is Justice League Power Rangers number one.
Now, this is not Justice League and Power Rangers, or Justice League versus Power Rangers. It is Justice League Power Rangers.
Yes, it is Justice League Power Rangers. But actually, Justice League Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, but splitting hairs.
Get a right read.
But yes, no, this actually, you know, features a crossover between the two teams, specifically about one of them sort of crossing into the DC world and then having the rest of the team follow.
Yep.
But it's just a lot of fun.
Tom Taylor
really kind of nails everything you need to know about the Power Rangers pretty quickly.
And we should say, I don't think any of us, Dave and I have never watched like much in the way of Power Rangers. And
Nick, you probably have seen a little bit more than we have.
I've definitely seen more than you guys have, but not a ton.
But you don't in any way need to be a Power Rangers fan to have to read this.
No, I think you have to.
If you are open to the idea of the Japanese Super Sentai teams kind of thing.
Or even if you're somewhat skeptical of it, like me.
Yeah.
But I mean, you don't need to have any love for. You have to love comics and good comics.
Everyone loves good comics.
True, but no, I just think Tom Taylor nails all of these characters, not only the Power Rangers, but also the Justice League members. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, this is something he got to be good at, I believe, in his Injustice comic.
Yeah,
is very quickly, you know, like being. That was released for digital first.
Yes, it was.
And in 8-page installments, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. So he kind of tends to, you know, try and pack a lot of stuff in. It's not to say that this is, like, dense with panels. It's a pretty breezy read.
No, but
there's a lot that happens in it and a lot of, like, cool scenes.
And especially if you know the characters a little bit. He packs in sort of, like, Easter eggs here and there for, you know, both Power Rangers and...
I also like that when you have these kind of mashups, like, why they meet is kind of important.
Yep.
You don't dwell on it, but you want to have a cool thing. And the way that they wind up in the DC Universe is a cool thing that ties into the way they work.
Yeah. Yep.
It's I was reading an interview with Tom Taylor and the really good artist, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a second, last night. And they were – maybe a couple nights back. And it really seemed like they got it.
Yeah.
You know, that they wanted a Power Rangers that had something of the lightness, light adventure quality of the show. He said the first issue feels, you know, will feel a little bit more Power Rangers than it will Justice League.
And it does, yeah.
And it does. And there's more of them than there are in this, but they do intersect with the Justice League. There is a little bit of rumbling going on, even though it's not a versus comic. There's some rumbling. And in fact, an amazing payoff.
The best last panel of any comic this week, I believe.
Easily, yeah.
But you know, let's go back to what Dave just said. Let's talk about the art a little bit.
Yep.
That artist is named Stephen Byrne.
Yeah, you compared him to sort of a more cartoony-looking Kevin Maguire, which I think is on target.
Yeah, or Amanda Connor, or anyone in that sort of ballpark. Yep. He just has got that expressive nature to his characters.
Well, that sort of rich painted color also reminds me a little bit of Daniel Acuña.
Oh, yeah.
Who I really liked, of course, on a lot of books lately, like Cap Sam Wilson.
But I want to specifically call out his ability to have the Power Rangers morph into their Power Rangers thing. It was a cool, nice little way he does it. And we even get it's morphin' time, which is fantastic.
Yep. You get to see the Power Rangers headquarters?
Yes.
See the robot thing?
Yep. See their fat-faced...
The blob-faced ghost man who gives them their marching orders.
That is Zordon. He's not a blob-faced ghost.
Doesn't he? He's kind of like... What I remember is this wavering...
He's like ethereal type.
Bloated
kind of
face that's sort of like... who's the thug dude? Skull? Is that like the...
From Power Rangers?
Yeah,
Skull.
Yeah, it's like bald Skull. This is based on my sorely lacking knowledge of Power Rangers. Oh, by the way, I did in the interview, they said, are we going to see Skull and who's his
I always
lackey
forget his lackey.
Or whatever. But yeah, they're the two sort of the bullies, Randy.
Yep.
The
bullies.
The Power Rangers have filmed their school scenes. And they're like cheesy 80s bullies, like very cokey kind of. And they said, are they going to be in there? And Tom Taylor was like, we really tried. We thought about it. It's like, I don't think so. He's like, but, you know, it's possible by the final issue they may end up having some
in the
role.
Current...
But I think he was like, it's too cheesy even
they
for
couldn't
us
do it, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
In the current Boom Mighty Morphin Power Rangers book, which I have to say, it has been quite good.
Uh-huh. Slightly more serious.
Slightly more serious. They have a backup little sketch that they do basically every
issue.
They just
rob a kid of his lunch money.
I think in some ways they have become like fans of the Power Rangers themselves.
Sort of a little bit more of that Flash Thompson.
Yeah, I was going to say the very Flash Thompson Spider-Man kind of dynamic. I just want to say this is a great crossover.
So we all liked
really
it too.
Yeah, we all liked it.
It was my potential pick. I thought he made all the designs look cool. That artist and it had well, you know, honestly, what it reminded me of, fun old Marvel DC crossovers.
Yeah. That's what I was saying.
I just wish there would be, we've been actually, and I say wish there would be more like that. We've been getting more like that.
Yeah.
Marvel's not participating in them.
No, but we've talked about how DC Dark Horse,
DC
Boom.
DC's doing a great
Boom
job.
Yeah. Yeah. Get on board, Marvel.
What was the other cool DC one?
Star Trek Green Lantern.
Yeah, Star Trek Green Lantern, surprisingly fun. The weird, like, Green Lantern Planet of the Apes thing coming up.
Yep. I like all these crossovers.
Yep. Marvel, get on the ball with this.
Dave, what is your pick?
My pick is also another franchise outside of the normal superhero franchises. This is from Dynamite Comics. This is a spinoff miniseries, I guess.
Yeah, it's a miniseries
From the James Bond comics, focusing on Felix Leiter, his CIA counterpart, who people have seen in various forms in the movies.
I thought that guy was black.
He was in one of the movies.
Why are they whitewashing Felix Leiter?
You know, very specifically, I remember this from reading the novels. He was described, first of all, he's a Texan. He's a sandy-haired Texan.
Yeah, do you remember
do
you remember who played him in one of the movies? It was a very Texan guy.
Was he even like a little bit mildly yokelish?
A little bit yokelish, yeah.
I don't remember. I mean, Dave was kind of going through sort of his, like, scenes.
Remember he called him Jimmy?
Well,
do you remember this?
No, that was not him.
Are you sure?
You're talking about, like, in, like, the one that's in, like, the South?
No. I'm talking about, I believe it was the Pierce Brosnan era, and their Leiter was a guy, it might even have been, like, Fred Thompson. Somebody like that.
Really?
And he called him Jimmy.
I
swear to you, unless
I don't think that was Felix Leiter.
I think you're wrong, but okay.
I'm sure it was not because the Pierce Brosnan era was when they did License to Kill and Felix Leiter had the scene where he got chewed up by a shark, which
no,
is...
Timothy Dalton was licensed.
Timothy Dalton. I see what you're saying. Yes, you're right. I'm mixing up my that era.
I am almost certain I'm right here. But I could also be completely wrong.
Nick's looking it up. You'll tell us.
I will tell you
at any rate.
Thanks for derailing with this dumb shit.
At any rate, my point is Felix Leiter has been numerous different things.
Yes.
Jeffrey Wright played him very memorably in the, I believe he's still playing him, in the current incarnation.
Right, right, the Daniel Craig stuff.
But this one goes back to sort of a, like a white Texan dude.
They've all been doing the kind of the closer to the books. It's been a while since I've read the Fleming novels, so... You know, I don't know how close this hues to it, but this is a kind of a... this is after he's lost the arm and leg, and they are... He's actually got stuff that pushes this into slightly speculative realm. Like, he's got what sort of would be like a cybernetic arm and leg.
I saw that.
And it specifically has to do with, it looks like, the storyline that Warren Ellis did. You know that guy and his nanotech and his
future tech? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think it is probably sort of cutting-edge, limb replacement therapy stuff.
I just see it on the cover. It seemed a little weird to me. Does it work? Generally work?
Yeah, I would say so, because they don't make a big thing out of it.
Okay.
But you do find out where, you know, in a flash... When it begins, he's just got it. It's not like it makes him super strong or anything like that. It just seems to make him essentially functional as an agent again.
Okay, so the last time we've seen Felix Leiter before Jeffrey Wright was in The Living Daylights, which was...
Oh, he's right. It's Timothy Dalton.
Timothy Dalton. And it was portrayed by John Terry, who played Christian Shepherd in Lost.
Oh, okay, so not at all what I was remembering.
No. Yeah. So you're...
I don't know what I'm remembering. Never mind.
I know the guy you're thinking of. He just wasn't Felix Leiter.
Who was that dude?
I don't know. Some jackass.
Okay.
You know how they have that, like, there's the dude who...
Was he in, like, all the Brosnan films?
You know who's the guy who at the end of... what's the one that had Xenia...
Xenia Onatopp?
Yeah. That was the famous
Goldeneye.
One.
That's
Goldeneye.
Goldeneye.
Who's the guy who shows up at the end, the fat dude who he and all his troops show up at the end? Like,
you mean Hagrid?
Is that who it was?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that was
him. His Russian dude?
Yeah, I think that was
him. Was he Russian?
He was Russian. That's not who I'm thinking of.
No, there was I remember this guy being American, but he's like, we're sending the troops, Jimmy.
Joe Don Baker.
Joe Don Baker, that's who I'm thinking of. Yeah, that was not Felix Leiter.
No.
I am wrong. Please continue.
I'm never going to get done with this review. All right.
Okay, tell us about
y'all, I made a Felix Leiter comic, and all of this background has nothing to do with it, and has no bearing on it whatsoever. When the story begins, he's seems like he's a little bit of a shell of a guy, having been so badly injured. And he's actually a private investigator now, but he's been asked to go on a mission, sends him to, Japan. He's been asked by his old pals at the CIA, so it seems like he's still got contacts with them. He needs to track down somebody who's an ex, of his, this being a Bond related story. She's of course a beautiful woman. She's a beautiful Asian woman. And they had a fling together, but obviously have bad feelings between them. It ended badly, and this is a very fast moving issue. She sort of gives him the slip, and then in tracking her down, they have a kind of tough physical altercation and interesting standoff, and the mystery deepens as to exactly what the interest in her is. And, you know, why the CIA wanted him to check her out. Obviously, the reason they called him onto the job is because they knew about his relationship with her and that he knew her well. And then there's some scenes deepen, too, and there's some flashbacks as to exactly how he got the robotic arm and leg. And this is some of the best stuff in it, I think, is sort of the bromance with him and Bond, which is... You know, traditionally shown up in the movies a little bit, but more in the book. Sometimes in the movies, he's just the guy who has Bond's back.
So Bond is in this?
Bond is in this.
Okay.
And in fact, he gives him the tech as a gift.
Okay.
So that's exactly, you find out more about it from him.
Here, have an arm.
And
Chip, pip, pip.
Their interaction is pretty cool. There's another guy from some of the Bond books and movies. But I don't want to say who it is. I'll go ahead and leave him for mystery. But there will be, there's yet another Bond character, related character, who shows up before all is done.
Is it Octopussy?
I'm not talking to you, Randy. And a big plot unfolding, which is this is what they need him to track her down for. And it's like, oh, the stakes are going to be pretty high in this. Anyway, James Robinson wrote this. He himself is an Englishman who you might know from Starman and from becoming a good writer again recently, after maybe a decade or so of floundering quite a bit.
Yeah.
He did his autobiographical comic with some fantasy elements, Airboy. He did some Secret Wars miniseries. I forget which one.
But you're right. There's a few that we liked. Yeah.
Versus whatever. And he's been writing Scarlet Witch, which he's been really good at.
Who's doing the art in this one? Because I saw when you were flipping
through it. Yeah, the art's good. It's got a sort of painterly look to it, a little bit like, let's say, a little dust and wind.
But it reminded me of Mads from The Killer.
Yeah, I can see that.
Intricate.
It's a good comparison. I don't know that many people know
who Mads is, but we do.
But you're not wrong. Yeah. You're not wrong.
The intricacies of like,
Aaron Campbell is the artist.
Oh, Aaron Campbell did something else for Dynamite with, I think, Andy Diggle.
Well,
I think Control, or maybe the second season of Uncanny.
Like the first page, the scene with Japan.
It's a really beautiful evocation of the city.
Aaron Campbell's a good artist. I liked his previous work.
But honestly, the reason I'm recommending this, I'm not like some super Felix Leiter fan. I'm only kind of a casual Bond fan, ultimately. Is honestly because of James Robinson's writing. All of the stuff that sort of sounds prosaic, a guy chasing a chick, that's normal stuff. Bond hanging out with Felix Leiter, that's predictable, and a dangerous problem they have to solve. None of that in and of itself is amazing, but his writing is quite good. Good dialogue exchanges, some pretty decent action sequences too. But honestly, like the scenes between Leiter and Bond, it's the writing on it that caught my eye. So
I feel like Dynamite's done pretty well with the James Bond license.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it seems like they've been treating it pretty seriously and been consistent too.
Warren Ellis, and I forget who wrote the second miniseries.
Yeah, it was somebody somewhat notable. Yeah,
well, Andy Diggle's doing the Hammerhead miniseries.
Andy Diggle's doing Hammerhead.
Well, what's interesting is that because this one so clearly ties into the past, they are building their own continuity, which is kind of cool. So like, if they had done each one of these as standalone and essentially like a movie, that would have been cool. But I kind of like the idea that they're taking the sort of the roots of the books, a little bit of the kind of high action of the movies, but a little bit of the keeping the mostly to sticking closer to the grittiness of the books, but building new characters and storylines and stuff that will all build upon each other.
Yeah.
The shared universe of James Bond.
Not a shared universe. It is, I suppose, but it's more just like if the Bond movies had kept, were more like the Daniel Craig movies have been, where they very clearly reference past ones.
Yeah, sure. Now, Dave, you say you're not a fan, but what about your honk if you love Felix Leiter bumper sticker?
That's actually a different Felix Leiter.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So my pick this week is a book I've been talking about for a while. I had the preview copies, and it is what I believe is Image's first big hit of the year. It is God Country Number 1 by Austin Boyd, Donny Cates, art by Jeff Shaw, who I'm not quite sure how to describe this. It definitely has a little Birthright feel to it, but it's not – there's definitely a different style to it beyond
that. And when you say Birthright feel, you should say like – it's sort of like conceptually like the Birthright has something to do with the Birthright plot. And for those who haven't read Birthright, it's a family who loses their son to and we find out he has been in like this fantasy world.
Right.
And then comes back as like this as an adult, and no time has passed for them. He's grown up.
Yep.
But it's like an alternate. It's like that weird world crossing thing. And there's something like that in this too.
But I'm mostly just talking about the art in this one. It's got that sort of gritty feel and that kind of thing. But
my brain wants to say like Sean Murphy, but it's not quite.
But you know, if people picture that though, who's the guy who usually works with Brubaker?
Sean Phillips.
Sean Phillips. There's a little bit of Sean Phillips in there.
At any rate, it's beautiful.
It's a Sean anyway.
It's a Sean.
It's beautiful artwork, colored by Jason Wordy, who is not a name I'm familiar with, so another good colorist. But this is a story of a Texas boy. He's grown up. He's got a wife and a young daughter, and his dad is dealing with Alzheimer's. They moved out of Austin and came to this sort of small Texas town. It's caused quite a bit of stress between him and his wife. His dad is like this old tough guy who's got Alzheimer's and is kind of gotten violent a little bit.
Yeah, becoming a little bit scary to the family and the locals.
It's not unheard of.
And the sheriff is telling him, you know, look, you got to put your dad in a home. And he's basically divided between his loyalties to his father and to his new family. And that is what the first half of the book is about. Actually, maybe in the first three quarters. And then there's like a supernatural event that happens, which turns everything on its head. And it's just it's a really interesting, promising opener. And one of those things where you're like, oh, this is a great first issue. I hope it follows up well. And I can tell you where they go with this in issue two and three is spectacular.
Yep. It's also one of those where it'd be very nice to be able to tell people what the twist is, but it would, or like twist, it's not a twist.
The reveal, yeah.
But the reveals are, because it's clearly going to set up what the book is, and it's not just about a sad family and their Alzheimer's dad.
No.
It is about how all of them are changed by this supernatural event you mentioned.
Yeah.
And it happens, there's some very specifically interesting things in it. But that's one of those you have to probably read for yourself.
Yeah, it's definitely not not a slice of life book. It just has strong characterization and
right.
Small Town Texas is very believably represented. But more to the point, this is more like something like Birthright or Preacher or Seven to Eternity, even a little bit. It's basically about world building and larger than life fantasy and that kind of thing. But that doesn't start till later.
Kind of darker fantasy.
Yeah,
that doesn't. I think if you've liked anything that Rennie has just compared this book to. You need to check this one.
Yeah,
out.
This is.
Or if
this,
you're just looking to see what the next big thing from Image might be,
and this will be.
I love this first issue. I loved all the character work. I love the premise. And like I say, I've had a little sneak peek at what's coming up, and I know that it's just going to get better from here. So, definitely worth a look.
Mr. Big Shag got a screener copy.
My backup pick is New Superman number 7. Now, this is a week when I think like 5 of my favorite Marvel books came out this week. And any one of them could be my backup pick. But I want to specifically mention New Superman number 7 because, A, I think it's the only DC book I'm reading.
Huh?
And that it's still in my wheelhouse to tell you something. And, B, this is a jumping on point. This is the start of Training Day where Kong Keenan, the Superman of China, basically starts looking for ways to get his full power unlocked. So while the Batman of China and the Wonder Woman of China are off doing their thing, he is going looking for a trainer. The trainer that he finds, I don't want to give it away, but it is such a great DC nod that I was like, oh, that's really good. And it looks like they're going to do sort of a Karate Kid type thing here where he sort of has a mean sensei who teaches him things. And the art continues to be great. It is, I believe, did they change artists on this one? They might.
I wish I had a mean sensei.
Yeah, I'll be your mean sensei.
You got the mane down.
Billy Tan.
You have the skill.
No. I can teach you the art of sarcasm.
Oh, great.
Billy Tan takes over the art on this, and he's really good here.
I've seen Billy in a long time.
This is a really fun issue. One of my friends, Dan, former staffer here, I was talking about my best of the year, and New Superman made my list of best comics of the year, and he said there are a few that I liked that he actively disliked. New Superman was one of them, and the reason he said is because it reminded him of the Connor Kent Superman, which took a while to grow on him. And I realized that he's right. This is a lot in common with the Connor Kent Superman, who I really liked.
Is it because like he's a cocky young superhero?
Yes.
Kind of like finding his...
Yeah, he very much is...
And is Dan kind of like just grow up and fly right?
I believe so.
And you're like, no, kind of the growing up and like the figuring it out and being a little overconfident is kind of part of the fun.
Yeah, exactly. I'm really liking this book, and I think this is a good jumping on point, and people should give it a look. Dave, what's your backup pick?
My backup pick is a new D&D comic called Frost Giants Fury. This is continuing the this is I think maybe the third, maybe fourth. Miniseries from Jim Zub with these characters. Notably, they have Minsk and Boo,
yep.
The hulking ranger and his miniature giant space hamster, who people love from Baldur's Gate video games and then from the Baldur's Gate comic that brought that Jim Zub kind of back, or Was that his first? What is that?
That was his first D&D comic. He did D&D.
He did Skull Kickers and stuff. That was D&D-esque.
But he did Baldur's Gate. I think is what it was, something about Baldur's Gate. And then he just did Shadow of the Vampire, which was the Ravenloft tie-in. So, and this is the next miniseries in that series.
And they recap it for you. There's actually kind of a neat introduction from him where he talks about his sort of the tone of Dungeons and Dragons and the kind of. And also get you up to speed on the characters, but essentially they previously tangled with the big vampire bad guy, Count Strahd.
Yep.
And barely survived. Not unlike the kind of thing that would happen to players going up against Count Strahd most of the time.
Yep.
He's one of the biggest bads that there is in D&D, and they barely survived, and in fact one of their members, when they return to our world, is basically dying. And unfortunately it's their healer. And so suddenly, and they're at the far north of the Forgotten Realms when they return, which is, what do they call it? The spine of the world,
yeah.
The big mountain range. I think that's where the Drizzt stuff sometimes happens, right?
Yeah, I believe so.
That's where their village is situated when that begins. But, anyway, so there's this survivalist element to the story at first. These characters have appeared with no particular, sheltering clothes and stuff, and essentially in a freezing, super brutal, snowbound mountain weather.
And Minsk is depressed.
Yes, it's a little. It did throw me at first, although he's still got his particular turn of phrase.
Is Boo depressed?
He's Boo's trying to cheer him up.
Yeah, Boo's supportive.
He gives him this. There's actually a great panel in here where he feels they failed to conquer evil, and they did. They lost to Strahd, basically.
They had to run away,
which I think is kind of cool.
Yeah,
to show that that there's some big bads you can't always take down. And he's looking at their beat up cleric, and he says, "Your body is a punctured pillow of pain." And he's talking about how weak they were, and Boo is putting a little comforting paw on him and squeaking comfortingly at him.
That's cute.
There's also as they're kind of in shelter and trying to figure things out. I was also, this is just kind of a weird thing to notice, but there's two of the rogue and
Both rogues.
Oh, they're both rogues. That's right. The halfling rogue and the elf rogue are arguing over something, and they have this extended whisper argument because everybody else is sleeping, and they're like, what do you think what you're doing? Which is just kind of entertaining to have a whisper argument. The whole thing is in whispers. This is not called the Frost Giants' Fury for nothing.
Right.
And before issues end, you get the giants. These have all been tied in lately with the big initiatives that they're doing, for the D&D Adventurers League.
Yep.
And, the modules and stuff coming out. So just as they had just previously done the Ravenloft Count Strahd stuff, they've been doing giant stuff recently, and I'm sure this will tie very directly into some of those things. And it's not just Frost Giants in here. There's ogres and other stuff going on. There's, action and stuff. This is a bit of an artistic change up and, a nice change up. I liked the previous artist, but it had gotten kind of to a slightly, maybe overly stylized place.
Yeah.
Like a little too cartoony.
Yeah, this art I like a lot.
Yeah, this is very much more the traditional, very elaborate kind of fantasy art with, detailed armor and swords.
Well, there's that great panel of them going into action. That's just a great panel.
Right, yeah. Kind of a classic, it'd be like the cover to a module or something like
it's
that.
It's the have it the moment.
Yep. And you get to see him fight some big dudes here. Jim Zub is one of those guys who he writes good action scenes. We've noted that it's a slightly forgotten art, or you don't find a lot of people who are really good at it. But there's some cool action scenes, a surprise possible new addition to the party.
Yep.
Zub
also clearly a gamer.
Right.
He talks in the opening about how he's like, now if you're used to Lord of the Rings fantasy, D&D is going to be a little weird. It's more quippy, and it's a little more action-y, and it is a different feel.
Right.
And I think that he nails the, this feels not like generic fantasy, but like D&D.
Right. It's not, exactly like what you play when you play it. There's probably less swearing.
It's a little less jokey than most of the D&D campaigns I've ever played. There's definitely an element of joking around the game table.
Right, but these characters do quip with each other.
Yeah, sure.
And, I'd almost say it's D&D by way of Firefly or something like that. The characters have a natural wit about them because the writer has a wit about him.
This is what you'd like to imagine your D&D looks like in the world.
Right, exactly. And yet the characters can still have serious moments and be badasses and all that too. Anyway, it's a chance to get in on a new one. Heroes fighting giants is always a pretty cool thing, yep. And each one of these ones has been sort of, you know, able to stand on its own, but I think this will probably be a particularly approachable one.
Yeah.
So, yes, check it out. D&D, Frost Giants, Fury.
Nick?
My backup pick is Titans number 7, which is just a one-shot, focusing on sort of the Titans adjusting to a new town. They now are in Manhattan. That's where they're setting up shop. There's a reason for that, but I'm not going to spoil.
Real cities.
Real
DC,
cities.
DC's yeah. not allowed to do real cities.
But the big portion of the big chunk of why I picked this up because it is pre-New 52 Superman meeting with pre-New 52 Wally West and sort of them kind of comparing notes, kind of reconciling that they're...
Is it a flashback? Or no, that's right. They're in the current.
They're in the current.
We're slowly but surely. It's like Maxwell Lord is... they're slowly but surely like the New 52 guys are taking over the Rebirth DC.
Yeah, that's kind of true.
It's like eventually the New 52 is going to be replaced entirely.
Right. If you don't like it, they'll have come back with yeah. the old characters.
But sort of comparing notes between the two, Wally talking about how Linda sort of doesn't remember anything. Superman kind of being Superman and being kind of a cornerstone and giving him a pep talk,
uh-huh.
which is, it just feels very Clark.
Superman should be doing that all the time.
Yep.
But there's also some great stuff with Nightwing and this woman who is, they've kind of gotten to help them kind of build up their base and make sure everything is legal, which sounds weird and boring, but sort of seeing her kind of involved with like all the paperwork of having to get like, you know, an aircraft, you know, flight plans and things like that.
They're like having some fun with an NPC.
Yeah, pretty much.
Supporting character.
And then there's sort of a back and forth between Donna Troy and Roy Harper, which is really, really good. There's just some fun kind of quips.
Did you say?
This is Dan Abnett, okay. Who has been writing the series the entire time and has been doing good stuff. However, this one sees sort of a change up in the art with Lee Weeks, and it's beautiful.
Lee Weeks is about as good as it gets as an artist, but
yeah.
We were talking about this earlier. He hasn't had a lot of really sort of prestige projects to kind of for people to remember.
He had a long run on Daredevil, but it was a while back.
Yeah.
Right, but Lee Weeks is very, very talented.
Yeah. Done, like Winter Soldier or something?
I was gonna say, he did a little bit of work on Brubaker era Cap.
Yeah.
But no, I thought this was a great issue and had some great moments for all the characters involved.
All right. What else is on your stack?
Then I've got a kind of scattering. I have the 12th issue of Spider-Man, the Miles Morales, which sees the crossover with Spider-Gwen.
Yeah, it looks really fun.
Yeah. The 16th issue of All New Wolverine, which continues the tale of Laura being reverted back to her old weapon state, and also Madripoor.
I love Madripoor.
I love Tiger Tiger.
Me too.
I remember the old Wolverine Tiger yep. Tiger stories,
yep.
and they were great.
All Wolverine stories should take place in Madripoor and have Tiger Tiger in them.
Sure.
Who's Tiger Tiger?
She's a crime boss who runs Madripoor.
She like, runs Madripoor. Yeah, she's okay. like the person you don't mess with.
Was she in The Death of Wolverine?
Yes.
Yes, she was.
Okay. I know who you're talking about. I just didn't. I didn't know that character well.
You thought she was just Tiger, but she is Tiger Tiger.
Oh, right. Like yeah. the poem.
The second issue of Inhumans vs. X-Men, which sees the war between the two factions continue to go on. There are some brutal fights with some of the X-Men members. Sabretooth and Human Torch. I would never have thought I would have wanted to see that fight.
I would have thought
fight.
Them pretty quick.
You'd be surprised.
Okay.
But I think, again, Jeff Lemire and Charles will continue to sort of bring a lot of nuance to this stuff, and I've been impressed with it. The 15th issue of The Mighty Thor, which is the new jumping on point, starts the story of the Asgard-Shire War.
If you wanted to see Gladiator fight Heimdall.
Yeah.
And who doesn't?
And fight Thor as well. So
yeah.
It's Russell Dodderman, who's been doing the art for most of the series. Occasionally mm-hmm. will go off, does some amazing work here. And then Justice League Suicide Squad number four, which continues the story, sees things go crazy, and introduces something from DC past that I hadn't thought about in a while. So
it's the Anti-Monitor, isn't it?
It's not the Anti-Monitor. It's something cooler than
okay.
that. And then there's an
some more pre-New 52 stuff.
And then there's the issue of Suicide Squad this week, number 9, which tells the tale of the first Suicide Squad team that Amanda Waller puts together. And that is sort of the Lobo, Rustum, Johnny Sorrow, team, and it was a bizarre, very violent issue, but very good. Then I've got the Detective Comics number 948, which starts the Batwoman Begins story arc, focusing on her character before she gets her own series, doesn't she?
Yeah, that's right.
We've been generally liking Detective quite a bit since the relaunch. So whenever there's a new jumping on point, that's probably a good time for you to consider checking it out.
Yeah, and then just a few more. I've got Flash number 14, which starts a new story arc with the Rogues. It says the return of Captain Cold. And then Uncanny Avengers number 19, which continues the Red Skull insanity.
Okay. Dave, what else is on your list?
Nick, did you mention the Vixen comic?
I did not.
Vixen, there's the Justice League of America one-shots that have been coming out to prep for the new team book coming up.
Right.
Has a Vixen special. I haven't read it yet, but... it's the same writer as the Atom one from last week.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And these seem to have been pretty popular with people. So it's a good. Generally, they've been kind of recaps, overviews of sort of the best of the characters, so you can kind of find out what their deal is. And I also just want to mention, since I enjoyed the first issue of it, have not yet read this late Totally Awesome Hulk number 14. These are the ones with the featuring basketball superstar Jeremy Lin having an adventure with the Totally Awesome Hulk. You know, to tell you what I liked about this is that normally walk-ons from celebrities and sports stars and stuff like that are exactly that, walk-ons. But, like, this is like Amadeus Cho got sort of lucky enough to meet sort of one of his heroes, and they genuinely bonded and hung out. And now it's like he's like buddies with him, and then he's kind of on an adventure. So I don't know. I kind of like that they're running with it.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's all I've got in my stack, though.
All right. As mentioned, a lot of my favorite Marvel books came out this week. Ms. Marvel number 14 is the start of a new story arc where we see, A, what Ms. Marvel's adventures in the world of Warcraft look like, basically. And then she has a villain who seems to be sort of a hacker, cybernetic type dude. So another new villain, interesting. Power Man Iron Fist number 12 is a big gang war issue. Has some really notable funny lines. Great character work. David Walker and Sanford Green are killing on this book, as they have been. Occupy Avengers number 3 is David Walker continuing to build this sort of street-level Avengers team where Hawkeye and Red Wolf go and recruit Nighthawk. And it's a really fun issue. And I'm glad to see some of these characters that... like Red Wolf was canceled, Nighthawk was canceled, both for low sales. I'm glad that David Walker is sort of rescuing them and giving them another shot to shine, because I think this is a really interesting book so far. Captain America number 9 is the Trial of Maria Hill, where we take a look at her history as a S.H.I.E.L.D. director and the things she's presided over, which include the debacle with the Cosmic Cube and Civil War and that kind of thing. And
why
she gets
on trial specifically?
Because of Pleasant Hill, because she, you know, right. used the Cosmic Cube.
Basically, right. It's like finding out that you were overseeing Abu Ghraib prison.
Yep. It is very much, and she gets to have her Jack Nicholson, you want me on that wall moment,
yep.
Which may work out better for her than it did for Jack Nicholson. And in the meantime, Captain America is off doing Hydra-y stuff, and we're learning more about exactly what his background is in this Brave New World and why he is with Hydra, which I believe is building up to the Secret Empire event coming to this year.
Did she order the Code Red?
She did not order the Code Red.
Okay.
Daredevil number 15 is the start of a new story arc, where Daredevil is dealing with a traumatic thing that happened to his protege, as well as, for some reason, putting out a hit on himself. I don't know why, but I'm curious to see where it's going.
He's putting out a hit on Matt Murdock, or Matt Murdock is putting out a hit on...
Matt Murdock goes undercover as Mike Murdock and puts a hit out on Daredevil.
Okay. Something is brewing.
Something is brewing.
Subplot is brewing.
Exactly. And then Doctor Strange and Sorcerer Supreme number 4, which is The Conjurer, another one of their sorcerers, gets her origin. Red Dog number 2, I know this is weird, but this was that sci-fi robots, aliens thing that Rob Cohen, director of the original XXX and Fast and the Furious, has. And I like the first issue. I've not had a chance to read the second one yet. Motor Crush number 2, like the first issue of that. Jessica Jones number 4. Silk number 16, which is a clone conspiracy tie-in. Skeptics number 3, which is the Black Mask about fake psychics in the sort of Cold War era. And then Injustice Gods Among Us Year 2, which collects Tom Taylor's second year of the Injustice comics, which we all really liked.
We're all shocked to so highly recommend a book. In many ways, still, you know, even though I do believe DC has done a good job of rebuilding with Rebirth, to me, the Injustice comics still feel closer to the DC I know and love than anything DC has done probably in 10 years now.
Agreed. And also, that is part of why it's Tom Taylor Tuesday.
Tom Taylor Tuesday.
Because there's also The Deep, number one, which adapts his all-ages animated series that he did for Netflix.
Three books in 1 week. I feel he must have coordinated this.
Yep. And I feel like there was something else, too. Like, another thing came out from Tom Taylor this week. So, Tom Taylor Tuesday.
Yes.
All right, that's it for us on comics. We'll be back in just a second to talk about books and games and TV and movies. Okay, we got a variety of things to talk about this week. I'm going to start with, I believe I mentioned earlier that Dave got me a Christmas present. Which breaks the rules, by the way. We're not supposed to buy a Christmas present for each other.
I know, but we had been talking about sci-fi novels.
Yes.
And it came up, and I was like, oh, I think Randy would legitimately like this one. It wasn't just one of those, I want Randy to read something because I like it. It was like, I think he will like it himself.
And I did.
And you did.
And the book is Forever War by Joe Haldeman. It is a sort of Vietnam-era science fiction war story. This is a guy who, I think it was 1974, he's a Vietnam vet. He wrote this sci-fi novel that sort of takes the look at war that sort of Vietnam informed.
Right.
And he had trouble selling it. This edition that you got me, Dave, has a foreword by current sci-fi writer John Scalzi that's really interesting,
yep,
where he talks about sort of the history. And then Joe Haldeman has a foreword where he talks about selling the book and how all the sci-fi publishers were really nervous about doing a sort of political sci-fi that, you know, the Vietnam War was very divisive at that point.
Sure.
And that he found a publisher that wasn't doing sci-fi. This was their first sci-fi book. And the result was this thing won like a Hugo and a Nebula and
right.
is a very respected piece of science fiction history
right.
that I had never heard of.
Right. In a way, it is like the successor, like the kind of more nuanced and gritty successor to Starship Troopers,
yeah.
which was pretty gung-ho, rah-rah-rah. Not as simplistic as the sort of you might think, but it was kind of jingoistic.
Yeah.
And this is the one that has to do a little bit more with all the moral compromising that Vietnam kind of brought out.
Yeah, well, they're at war with an alien race they call the Torrens. They don't know that much about them. There's definitely an implication that we started it,
uh-huh.
and that maybe there's something more to this. But it breaks into three chapters. So our lead character was born in 1977, and the war starts in, like, 2007.
Oh, wow, I forgot that.
Yeah.
It's been a while since I've read it.
And the book ends in, like, the year 3000-something.
Right, because...
Because when you travel, there's a time dilation effect.
Right.
And so he would be, like, when he gets done with his first tour, he goes back to Earth, and it's, like, 250 years later.
Right.
And things have changed notably. And that was when I really... The book's broken up into three sections, or four sections, actually. It's like the early... His first tour, where they do a lot of stuff about the technology and their battle suits that are so dangerous they can't even lean against the ice or the hydrogen will blow up.
Right.
And they can't... If they try to run in it, they could fall down and break their backs. And it's very much interesting about sort of the battle suits and early technology. And then he goes back to Earth, and there's like... That 70s sci-fi of overpopulation and violent crime, and the world has gotten to be sort of this terrible place. And then, you know, they go back to his next tour, and the technology's changed, and the war has changed, and then he gets promoted, and there's all this stuff. And in between there, there's sort of a weird romantic thing where he hooks up another officer because there is a very much like it's an integrated military. There are men and women in the military, and there's sort of a casual, they all sleep with each other kind of thing.
Right. Just accept it.
Yeah. And that story develops into a different thing, and then he, you know, comes back to Earth a couple times when it's very different. There's a lot of sort
of... One of my favorite things about it was those times he would return to Earth, and each time hundreds of years would have passed, or at least a couple hundred, and you would get these very different pictures of how society was evolving.
Yeah. Well, and it's speculative sci-fi in a way, but it's also, as you and I were talking about off mic, was that... It was very telling of how the Vietnam vets experienced the war. They went off, they came back to America, and it totally changed on them.
Right. And now, this is like in very wild, world-changing ways,
yeah.
which is kind of a neat thing that sci-fi can do. So it's not like you read that and you're like, oh, I see, this is a reflection of the Vietnam soldiers' experience. But anybody, you know, people who've been to war do, and especially I think in Vietnam, they came back to find a very changed country, or what felt like a very changed country. And this, in that larger-than-life sci-fi way, reflects that.
Yeah, it's a great book. I really liked it. And now that I've read it, they're doing a comic by Titan, and I'm really interested to see it adapted in sort of a visual medium. So thank you, Dave. I really much, very much enjoyed it. And I guess next up for me is Logan's Run, which you also got me.
Yeah. I feel like Logan's Run is a much more iffy one. It's one of those that where this one is a nostalgic book for me, and I'm not sure if you'll like it. It's more of a pulp sci-fi, like as pulp gets.
Well, I've read...
It's one cliffhanger after another.
I read, like, half of Logan's Run one day in the middle school library, and I remember really enjoying it.
Right. So. It is, like, a short book, like 180 pages, or... No, like, less than that. It's, like, 140 pages or something.
Also, that does remind me, though, young Randy could read a book in a day or two.
Yeah.
Old Randy cannot read books that fast. This was not that deep... This was not that heavy of a book. This is, like, a few hundred pages, and it took me a week to get through it.
Yeah, well, you know, young Randy didn't have to pay bills.
Yeah.
Young Randy didn't have to work and crap.
Young Randy didn't have to play Overwatch.
I hate Young Randy. I'm going to kill that guy.
Let's go back in time and kill Young Randy.
Yeah. I see no way that could... Speaking of, the other thing I want to talk about is a time travel show.
Whoa.
Where you go back in time.
I didn't mean to lead it, but I did.
Yeah, but you did. Which I know, Nick, you've watched some of?
No, I have not.
You've not, okay.
I want to because I've heard good things.
What is the show?
So this show is called Travelers. It's a Netflix original.
Uh-huh.
It is a story about the... It's a really interesting opening.
Surely all time travel stuff has been done.
You would think. And yet, the notion of this is that the travelers are sent back. There's these opening scenes are all show these people and they're like a little screen thing. A little thing pops up, a little Chiron that says moment of death. And it gives the time and it starts counting down like the seconds. And about 30 seconds before they die, whether it's being woman who's developmentally disabled is being attacked in a parking lot by four sort of street toughs.
Yep.
I think there's a guy who has a heart attack. There's a heroin user who's about to shoot up an overdose.
Uh-huh.
Because they're in the future, they know when these people died. And because they're about to be removed from the timeline, they can just take them over. So they basically send a consciousness back.
That's what they did in the Sound of Thunder Ray Bradbury story. Yeah. You would hunt dinosaurs that they knew from looking through like lenses back in time were going to die anyway.
Yeah. So they overwrite their consciousness like 30 seconds before they die, and they have this painful death where the person – their consciousness is overwritten, and then the time traveler gets up, prevents the death, usually by means of karate kicking because they're all trained Kenshin combatants. And then they all meet up together, and they're working for this mysterious director in the future who sends them directives. And they've got things like Protocol 6, where you're not supposed to interact with the other cells. There's thousands of travelers back here, but they work in teams of like five or six. And the mission they go on, one of the first missions they go on is to prevent this experimental antimatter bomb from going off and killing like 11,000 people.
Right.
But they this team is basically operating on this abstract concept of the director. They're trying to prevent a future where humanity's all but wiped out. It's sort of a dystopian future. And the director sort of sends the messages either by means of they have this thing called the messenger where they can send messages into the brain of prepubescent children because they won't take brain damage from it.
It's like they're...
So like a Girl Scout will walk up to them and this robotic voice will give them a message and then the kid's like, what happened? And then wander off.
Crazy.
And they're like, oh, that's kind of creepy. And they use that and then they get their missions and they're not supposed to interact with anybody else and they're supposed to do these things and they're not supposed to do... They got all these protocols that keep coming up. Like,
so they broadly know that the, like these little tweaks they're making to the timeline are going to like hopefully prevent some bad future?
Yes, because the director is thinking of it. But they have a Protocol 6, which means you don't take a life and you don't save a life.
Huh.
So you're not supposed to save any lives outside of the mission goal, and you're not supposed to kill anyone outside of the mission goal. And it's really interesting. I'm four episodes in, and I know that our buddy Les Weiler loves it. He's also a big time travel guy. But
He's also a time traveler.
But they start off where it could be sort of a procedure, like, oh, they get the mission, they go to the mission. But they're already sort of tweaking the formula so that it doesn't get old. And they're definitely going into sort of morally gray territory.
So it's not going to be formulaic, like every week they have an adventure kind of thing?
No. They're definitely looking at the morality of this technology where they're basically, you know, overriding personalities and interrupting people's lives. And, like, one of the characters is married and has to interact with this woman who is his wife, even though he's in love with one of the other travelers. Like, the two of them are having a relationship. And it's one of them has a kid they didn't know. The developmentally disabled woman is suddenly like fully functional. And it's freaking out her social worker, who's like her buddy, and she didn't know because they got all the information from a Facebook profile that was created as like a self-esteem building exercise. So their information is imperfect.
Right.
And it's really, really good. I definitely recommend it. It is it's pretty solid budget. It's got Eric McCormick from Will and Grace as one of the leads.
Yep.
And I would say that if you like stuff like alphas, that kind of thing, this is on the level of stuff like that.
Is this like a 10-episode?
10 episodes. I'm sure they'll do a second season.
Yeah. Any Terminators in it?
Not so far. I'm only 4 episodes in.
Any John Connors?
Only 4 episodes in.
Okay.
There is a director.
There is a director. Other thing I want to talk about was a game that I finally played, which is Patchwork.
This is the game that like is the hardest selling sounding two player game that is very well regarded.
Yep.
But if you tell people, are you ready for quilting?
Yep. The two player competitive quilting game that is sweeping the nation.
But the pedigree of it is I don't know how you say his name. Uwe Rosenberg.
The guy that did Agricola.
And Caverna, he is one of the biggest, brightest names in gaming right now.
Also, this is specifically a two-player game, which is a hard, fun thing to find.
Yep.
Anyway, we've been sort of recommending this on the basis of reviews and stuff, and I finally wanted to play it. And I did, and it's a lot of fun. It's got a little bit of a Tetris element to it. You're basically trying to fit these pieces into your quilt.
Uh-huh.
And the spaces if you have spaces in your quilt, it subtracts points at the end. If you can build a 7x7 grid, you get bonus points. Mm-hmm. And each piece may have buttons on them. When they have a button, it is sort of the currency that lets you buy more quilting pieces.
Hmm.
And so you go around this little board. You and your opponent have a button on the board. And when you pass your opponent, it's their turn. And so you can sometimes get like 2 or 3 turns before they get a turn.
Uh-huh.
And then when you pass the little buttons on the board, you get whatever your buttons on your quilt are as your money to spend on buying pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, it's very Tetris-esque. You're trying to fit these things into as much of a solid piece you can. And then later on, there's 4 patches on the board. There may be more. But if you can pass your opponent and get to the patch, you get the little patch and you can fill in one space on your quilt where they don't get to. So it's really fun, really easy to learn, but there's a lot of strategy to it, like when you buy these pieces, how many spaces you want to move, that kind of thing. And I really enjoyed it. It is definitely a fun game, and I would recommend it to people.
What's the play time on something like this?
Pretty quick. I would say 20 to 30 minutes, maybe.
Nice.
And then, Dave, we're going to talk about the movie challenge, but I know you and Nick both watch Hell or High Water.
Yep.
Yes.
I think one of the highest rated movies of like 2016.
Yeah,
it's well regarded. Did it win any Golden Globes? I can't remember.
I don't know.
I don't think it did, or if it maybe
had. Notably has
Jeff Bridges.
You know, I heard this. My sister compared this movie, or she heard me talking about No Country for Old Men, and she's like, "Oh, if you like that, did you see Hell or High Water?" And I can see why she brought it up in the sense that. Very broadly speaking, they do kind of reflect each other. This kind of like, is it like West Texas?
Yeah.
And just as Tommy Lee Jones was this sheriff in pursuit of stuff going on with, Anton Chigurh, the, you know, unstoppable hitman in that. Not quite the same, but there's a craggy old sheriff played by Jeff Bridges. In this case, he's after two kind of morally bankrupt bank robbers, but not wholly irredeemable,
no.
Especially Chris Pine's character.
I thought at times like Jeff Bridges' character was kind of
a racist bastard.
Yeah,
he was a mean old racist bastard.
I mean, I'm very kind of like, who doggy? Let's have some action. Let's kill some people.
Right, a little bit.
I was a little put off by his trigger happiness.
Yeah. So I believe you ended up like quite liking the movie.
I did.
I
very
actually,
much so.
The, in a weird way, what you said kind of hits on why I kind of disconnected a little bit early on from it, even though I think it's like a really well-crafted movie. I found it engaging throughout. I just wasn't quite it wasn't up for me, which is I thought there was a certain slickness of dialogue. There's a lot of like Jeff Bridges' character is very witty in his kind of cranky old, slightly racist way. And by the way, his racism comes out because he has a Native American partner, or half Native American, maybe.
He's half Native American.
And he makes lots of jokes about it. They're kind of funny. A lot of those movies, he's naturally.
Yeah, he's very
charismatic. Jeff Bridges at his most charismatic and kind of charming, cranky old man. And he's not also a little bit, you know how Tommy Lee Jones was in No Country for Old Men, where he had that wry sense of humor about everything?
Yeah.
There is absolutely some of that to his character. But I sort of felt like the scenes felt, like, somewhat contrived to me. Like, they were a little, like, they were meant to give you some kind of, a little too, few too many kind of crowd-pleasing scenes.
I don't know if I ever felt that. I felt there was just sort of this attention to detail, sort of all throughout, that instead of being sort of fast-paced, slick, like, heist movie, like, the action pieces from Heat, it's very kind of sedate in its sort of portrayal of things.
Actually, and Heat has a lot of sedateness to it, too, technically.
Yeah, it does.
I actually don't think Heat is a terrible comparison in the sense that,
you know, I
this
that
does
now.
Do something of the... Although they don't have the Bond going on, there is something of that to the movie between the cops and the robbers, so to speak.
There are.
And there is, you know, you see from both angles. It has that sort of... Nick, do you feel like it sort of had like a West Texas noir kind of feel?
Oh, very much
Because
so.
It did sort of feel like, man, I don't know what's going to happen to these characters, but it feels like they're spiraling to something bad.
Yeah.
They're not like quite like total losers. You know, Chris Pine has some wit about him, and some cleverness.
Oh, he's definitely the smart one.
His brother, who's just out of prison for reasons that are somewhat sympathetic, actually, when you find out why. His brother, like, seems like he's the riskier guy, the guy in the bank robbery who could go a little crazy at times.
Yep.
But when you find out why he was in jail, you're like, oh, well, geez, I guess I can kind of understand how I might have gone down this path.
Yeah, I mean, they are portrayed as sort of like, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, the villains of the piece.
Right.
But they're not unsympathetic. They're not very kind of just one definition. And I liked both of the characters. I thought Chris Pine showed a few more acting chops than
Have seen him as Captain Kirk in the new Trek movies. And he was solid, perfectly solid in what the role called for, kind of a cocky Captain Kirk.
Movie about like a ship, like Harm's Way, or it was one of the most boring pieces of junk that I have seen in quite some time.
But it wasn't because of him.
He was pretty kind of
flat. He is somewhat understated in this, but he kind of like he's got a bit of good old boy to him.
It
you know, they
the
both for sure
playing.
Both of them do. And he's definitely the more nuanced of the two brothers.
Ben Foster is kind of insane.
He's got a he's got an ex-wife who plays a role in it, and an estranged son, concerns about them, and yet his wife is no friend of his really.
However, I won't spoil anything, but it went in different ways than I was expecting. I thought I'd figured the movie out like midway through, and I had not. So
right, and I had not either. I still it's more like. In a weird way, this is why I think most people will like it, and why it's got like a 98% rating on Rotten Tomatoes. It reminded me a little bit of what I don't like about Brian Vaughn, which is to say, individual scenes were kind of expertly packaged and done, but I just sort of felt like the writer's hand in them, maybe. I can't quite tell why that set me off a little bit, and like I love No Country for Old Men so much, but. I didn't think it was predictable. It felt like noir in the sense that it was that like, man, something bad's going to happen. I don't know what, but I did not know like precise. At any point did I think I know exactly what's going to happen? At no point did I feel that, and I did feel that it ended pretty strongly.
Yeah.
Like the way it particularly resolved was some very interesting last few scenes.
So this is not streaming anywhere, right?
No, unfortunately, you're going to have to either buy it or go to a Redbox.
It's new enough that I'm sure it's pretty prevalent.
Or rent it off of Amazon.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I feel like it's pretty prevalent at Redboxes, and yeah, I'm sure it's...
Yeah.
I'll probably just wait till it shows up. I got plenty of stuff to watch.
Yes.
But I do want to see it. I do want to see it. Yeah, but I'm in no hurry.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be very up your alley, Randy.
Yeah,
I think so as well.
Chris Pine pays hell, and the other guy is High Water.
Yeah.
And together they...
Are Hell or High Water.
Hell or High Water.
Yeah.
You're going to get one or the other in almost every scene.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. All right. That wraps it up for us this week.
Yes.
We'll be back next week with more. And until that time...
Yo-jo!
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating or review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.